Stories from Sydney on FBI.
Be very quiet. Wherever you are, you might be. Well, if you're anything like me, you're probably listening to this on the bus. Might be driving your car. Maybe you're at the hairdresser getting your hair cut and you're listening to the radio and it's just started up. It's All the Best on FBI radio. But, you know, you're not wherever it is that you thought you were. You look around and you can see these books. You can smell this musty smell, and there's someone diving deep into the Dewey Decimal. Today on All the Best, we're in the library, and that's our theme today. It's our second in our series of shows about books. I'm Matt Levinson, and today I'm sitting in for Eliza Zalos, who is very appropriately stuck in an exam this morning. She's been studying away, probably in a library. Today we're bringing you stories we recorded late on a Thursday night in May as part of a special night at Surry Hills Library. It was all about late night library, being out at the library late. First up, let's go back to where it all began, learning to read. But Eddie Sharp didn't, actually. In fact, he couldn't. Let's go out with Eddie on a journey through his childhood and hear about his experience with reading, writing, and libraries. But this is no fairy tale, and there's a content warning on this one, kids. So stay tuned.
I don't want to get anyone's hopes up. I'm not going to publicly masturbate in a library in this story. It's more an analogy. All right. My story is called Public Masturbation. My earliest memory is of stealing a Sesame Street activity book from my preschool library. I had recently become aware that at such a young age, you could pretty much steal anything and get away with it. No one ever suspects the sweaty, anxious-looking three-year-old in the line of the Campbell's Cash and Carry. No one thinks to check that there may be an errant pack of beef stock cubes burning in the hole in the front pocket of his Oshkosh bagoshes. The object itself never really mattered. I would bring these things home and hide them under my bed, occasionally bringing them out to look at them in the same way serial killers covet trophies of their victims, like a foot or a necklace of teeth. The Sesame Street book sat under my bed for many years after I stole it. It was evidence that I was a bad kid, a liar and a thief. In all those years, I never read it. I mainly liked it for the cover. Bert, Ernie and Big Bird all sitting on top of a teetering tower of alphabet blocks. Also, I couldn't read. A fact that I was somehow able to hide from my parents and teachers until I was 8 years old. It wasn't entirely my fault. My primary school was so dangerously understaffed, they ended up streamlining my kindergarten with first and second grade into one big unruly class in the school hall. The simpler activities, like drawing or singing, were done together, but when it came time to do something more serious, like learning to read, we would be separated into our age groups and sent to different parts of the room. I would hide in the grade 2 section, and, running my finger across the words I didn't understand, I would drone along with the older kids like an Anglican dirge. It was a stupid thing to do, but I did it for love. I was in love with two people in that class. Veronica, a prim and beautiful Polish girl with perfect posture, who was just tall enough for me to hide behind and creepily smell her hair. The other was a weird-looking girl with a bowl cut who usually sat to my right and would wordlessly tug on my arm and then, giggling, pull down her underpants and graphically splay open her vagina. I still can't remember her name, but her influence was so intense that I would still be able to pick her out of a lineup. She was skinny and mousy looking with a similar expression on her face to the one that was just behind me. Even at the time, I was aware that it was an exciting privilege to be singled out like this. But who knows, maybe she did it for everyone. Or maybe she could just smell her own kind because I was also a notorious weirdo. At recess, I would often stand on the most central bench in the playground and slowly strip myself naked while singing Hey Big Spender, trying to get through the first verse before a teacher would come and just collect me with a mixture of shock and embarrassment. I thought it was hilarious, and I still think it's pretty funny. I was also a compulsive masturbator. So much so that I was sent to the hospital with a severe penis infection when I was 4. My penis had blown up to the size of a Chevapchichi sausage, which doesn't sound that big, but is pretty big for a 4-year-old. After the operation, the doctor told me if I kept playing with it, they would have to cut it off. At the time, I actually believed him, but even that couldn't stop me. My school eventually found out that I was illiterate, and so I was put into a special class with other idiots who ate glue and diddled with themselves and couldn't be controlled. By the time I was 8 years old, however, I was better at reading and writing than most kids in the school. This rapid ascension from dumbest kid in the school to one of the smartest gave me a megalomaniacal self-belief that I was better than other people, and also that I wasn't, that it was a fluke and that I would somehow be found out. I loved reading Mad comics and became obsessed with the idea of Ed, who would pop up in the pages all the time to add little comments and correct the writers and illustrators. It was, of course, an abbreviation for editor, but I was convinced that it was an amazingly witty know-it-all called Ed. Being an Ed myself, I thought it was the divine calling for Eds everywhere to interject when needed, to correct, to wittily deflate the dreams and aspirations of others with little post-it notes and comments. This became my role in life. I wasn't particularly smart, but I became very good at seeming smart. I would bring impossibly large books to school, like I, Claudius or Moby Dick, and pretend I was reading them, and mock other kids for the books that they were actually reading. In school plays, I was usually cast as the narrator, which I took as further affirmation that I was special and better than everyone. I know now that the narrator is where you put the weirdo, the loose cannon, the compulsive masturbator. My best friend at the time was an incredibly smart kid with weird jutting teeth called Hannibal. He had a wall eye and a massive head on a very thin neck, which sort of made him look a little bit like Yoda or Oscar the Grouch. He was incredibly shy and awkward. Two examples of Hannibal's intelligence were that one, when the rest of the class were learning math, he didn't have to join in and instead worked on a separate, more advanced textbook by himself. And secondly, and probably more importantly, we had those desks with a compartment underneath them, and he actually tilted ours at the front and, using rubber bands, stationary marbles and a small screwdriver, modified them into fully working secret pinball machines that only the two of us knew about. The friendship was a mutually beneficial alliance. My aggressive precociousness acted as an armor for his odd-shaped head and extreme sensitivity, and his actual inarguable brilliance legitimized my pretensions. By the time we were 10, me and Hannibal were both placed in a special gifted and talented class. On Friday afternoons after lunch, we would be taken away in a minibus to the Sydney Uni Library and encouraged to do Edward de Bono-style brain teasers. The format was incredibly loose and fun compared to actual school. I still wasn't exactly sure what I was doing there, and neither were the other kids. Taken out of their natural environment, the normal hierarchy of school had been completely subverted and the nerds have gone feral. They turned on me. They bullied me. They would roll their eyes whenever I spoke and make it clear to the other teachers that I didn't belong. I remember overhearing them complaining to our teacher, "He's not even clever, he's just a wanker." I also remember the teacher quietly agreeing with them, which was even more shocking. I then hid even further behind my defensive mechanism, became a bigger know-it-all, made a point of arriving late and getting away with doing the bare minimum. I believe that people's essential natures never change. 10-year-old me was a child version of the kind of person who refuses to get a real job or a driver's license and instead dedicates their lives to niche pursuits like blogging or slam poetry or fringe theatre. I was a pre-evolutionary artsy wanker. The kind of person who uses public readings at community libraries on Thursday nights as some sort of thinly veiled group therapy. As I was writing this the other day, I came across the last story I wrote for Gifted and Talented, which has a weirdly defiant, aggressive tone and also obvious plagiarism that pretty much sums up my attitude towards everything by that point. I quit the class a week later and then became a steady B-grade coaster for the rest of my high school career. This story is a response to Huckleberry Finn, and it's called Tom and Becky Still in the Bloody Cave. We now return to Tom and Becky, who are still trapped in the cave alone and helpless, surviving only by their wits. And who else should be in the cave with them but the cruel and savage Outlaw Joe, who would do anything to... Now wait just a second, 20 boy. Outlaw Joe. That's right. I'm upset about what you've been writing in this stupid little book of yours. But I don't understand. How are you real? How did you come out of my story? Shut up, book boy. I'm the narrator now. So where were we? Oh yeah, that's it. I was just about to get my mitts on those dumb little cave kitties. I had just killed my partner by drowning him in the Mississippi, which brought me to the mouth of the cave, which brought me here hiding in this smelly old cave. I started sleeping. I had a real thing for getting the G off things. I started sleeping. Ever since those two dumb boys snitched on me, I ain't got no sleep. I suddenly woke with a start, and who should be walking into the cave but Huckleberry Finn. I jumped up as quick as a flash and caught Huck. I asks, why is he here? He says he was looking for Tom, which be my same reason. He then asked me if I'd seen Tom around. I said, yep, I ate him, and the little tyke believed me and fainted right there and then. So as I thought, if he's there and I'm hungry, I might as well eat him anyway. So as I did. The next day, Tom and Becky showed up, and I killed them in the cave with Huck's ribcage. I ate him as well. You know, being a cannibal ain't a bad way of getting fed. I may switch to it. Beats robbery any day. The end.
Zodiac to see you. Might be a zinger if you zero out in this zoo. Now I gotta zoom. I'll let you catch some Z's. 5,000. I'm out of here. Peace. Please, please, please. Don't perpetrate. Punk ass pussy.
You're listening to Del the Funky Homo Sapien, or at least you have been listening to Del the Funky Homo Sapien with a track called From A to Z. From his record Golden Era that came out this year, a little bit earlier this year. You're tuned in to All the Best on FBI 94.5. That was a little bit sticking back onto autopilot. So great to be back in the studio here at FBI, and some of those things have just gone into my deep back memory. You're actually on All the Best here on FBI, and well, this week it's all about books and libraries. We're playing readings that were recorded at Surry Hills Library not so long ago. And that last one was from Eddie Sharp. He was using the live audience at Surry Hills Library as a kind of group therapy to get over what sounds like a traumatizing childhood experience with a big bad book. We're sure he'll live happily ever after. We've seen the evidence. As I said, you're on All the Best here on FBI Radio. And if you have a look around, I reckon you'll get the vibe that where, you know, there's musty books, there's paper flapping, there are people studying. It's quiet, I guess. We're in a library. I'm sure you can smell it too. Vanessa Berry loves that smell. In fact, as a younger woman, she just couldn't get enough of it.
Hello. Yes, this is about the Dura Library and also a bit about my primary school library, because it's a bit of a memory kind of piece going back to my childhood. So there are some people who obviously should have been born in another time, and I felt like one of them. But as much as I tried to convince myself otherwise, the reality of it, that I was a kid in the 1980s. Later on, as a teenager, while stuffing my Cabbage Patch Kid in a bag to take to the op shop, I thought of the oath I had recited upon adopting it back in 1985. I promise to love my Cabbage Patch Kid with all my heart. I promise to be a good and kind parent. I will always remember how special my Cabbage Patch Kid is to me. I didn't feel guilty. I'd never been fond of the doll, with its piggy eyes and chubby cheeks, which resembled a face after a wisdom teeth extraction. I'd convinced my parents to buy me one for Christmas for no reason other than succumbing to peer pressure. It watched over me in my room, occasionally whispering, "You must conform." The world I would have rather been living in, rather than the 1980s, was about 100 years earlier, and my main way of accessing this was through the Dural Public Library. Here I gravitated to the hardback classics, like The Water Babies or Secret Garden. I liked the smell of the books, which had soft pages like blotting paper, and colour plates for the illustrations, which I examined with great attention. I'd take them up to the counter and watch as the librarian crunched the stamp down on the due date page. What I would have given for a go of that stamp. Once stamped, the books were mine, and I had an armful of different worlds to disappear into. The Dural Library was my favourite, although, of all the places at my school, it was the library where I felt most comfortable. That and the gates when I was leaving at the end of the day. The librarian, who saw in me the kind of gentle, easily trampled soul who takes refuge in books, eventually entrusted me with the job of checking books out at the desk. The small plastic stamp was no match for the public library one, but I used it proudly. One day in the school library, I spied some of the mean girls who usually held court in the playground, grouped into a corner, examining something. Seeing these bullies on my turf, I felt nervous, but was too scared to go over and investigate. I lurked behind the shelves nearby for a while, listening to them giggle. Then I thought of something. The checkout desk was located on a level above the library itself, with a good view over it. So I climbed the stairs and peered down. Directly below me, in between the bowed heads of the girls, I could see what they were looking at. A copy of Where Did I Come From? I knew very well where they came from. Big North Shore houses with pools and tennis courts. The kind of places with confidence pumping out through the air conditioning. Where I came from, I was less sure. I'd read my children's classics from the library and imagined myself as an orphan, a gypsy, or a girl detective. Although they were library books, and I knew they had been read by others, traces of whom, in the crumbs and finger marks on the pages, were still apparent, I knew that I was the true recipient of this knowledge. Visiting the library on Saturday was the highlight of my week. In Dural Mall, as I trailed round after my mum in the Franklands, I tried my best not to become impatient. There were some distractions. My sister and I were obsessed with the plastic egg machines at the entrance to the supermarket. One of these dispensed bouncy balls, and we had a growing collection of these at home in itty-bitty bins. The shopping done, I felt great anticipation as my mum's car pulled into the library car park. The library was surrounded by gum trees like a magic house in a wood. It was a 1970s building with an angled roof and exposed brick interior, a style of architecture I found comforting. Once Monday rolled around again, I was back at school. Despite my loner in the library tendencies, I did have a few friends. Although I felt like we were from different planets, I was grateful to them for putting up with me. But things started changing. There was increasing pressure to be interested in boys. It was an all-girls school, and up until this point, boys, apart from brothers, had no particular importance. Now Debbie, the leader of our group, had a crush on a boy and expected us to follow suit. If we didn't have a real boy, a crush on a movie star was permissible. Everyone but me eventually came up with someone, and I knew that my excuses wouldn't hold up much longer. My kind of boys rode horses, wore waistcoats, and could converse with animals, and the only pictures I had of them were in the colour plates of hardcover books. How I wished I could bring one to life. That weekend, I again visited the library. It was such a holy place for me that I imagined any problem I had could be solved within its doors. In the children's section was an area with beanbags for kids to sit reading. I'd never paid much attention to this area before, but today I noticed the magazine rack. If I ever read a magazine, it was selected from the news agency when my parents bought the weekend papers. They were about horses, or were the kinds of magazines where kids would send in their art and fiction to be published. I'd managed to live my life as free from engagement with popular culture as possible up until this point, but I knew the time had come. At the magazine rack, I picked out a smash hits and flipped through it. A dastardly plan bloomed as I noticed the posters of pop stars and movie stars inside. I looked over to the desk and saw the librarians were busy stamping. I chose one of the full-page posters and ripped it out slowly so the noise wouldn't be heard. I stuffed it in my pocket and went to borrow The Wolves of Willoughby Chase by Joan Aiken, in which a pair of girls escape their evil governess with the help of a boy who lives in a cave in the nearby woods. The poster was of Charlie Sheen. I thought he looked rather weaselly, but he became my alibi. I could profess how cute I thought he was and how my perfect man would be just like him. Little was I to know the monster he would become. Yet now, when I read about his latest ravings, I think about that poster. If my friends came to visit, I'd stick it up on my wall, right above the spot where the Cabbage Patch Kid sat, the evidence that I was a normal girl, just like everyone else.
That was Vanessa Berry talking about Sydney's Dural Library here on All the Best at FBI. The wonderful Camera Obscura, with a song of theirs called Pen and Book, from a few years ago, I guess. And that is an amazing repetitive sound that's coming in from the next track. It's the amazing behind-the-scenes tour of our studio at the moment. You're listening to All the Best on FBI 94.5. Stick around for a story about a book that rightly or wrongly gets people frightened. It's one of those ones that people always pull out when they're talking about scary books. Elmo Keep's going to be talking about her first experience with American Psycho a little bit later in the program. But for now, well, I'm Matt Levinson. I'm covering for Eliza Zalos today, and you're listening to All the Best. And first, away from our little city to a place where it sometimes seems anything is possible, Japan. And it's there you'll find something called Manga Kissa, a form of library that houses comics, a place that anybody can go and read graphic novels anytime they please. Bryony Doyle takes us into this juxtaposed world of the controlled imagination, and, well, we know we're talking about comic books here, but there's a bit of language and a bit of a content warning on this one, so stay tuned for that.
It's almost midnight in Fukuoka City when I head in out of the nightclub back alleys and into the cool silence of a manga kissa. To the uninitiated, manga kisses are Japan's number one terminal teen nerd out space and refuge from the sprawl. It's kind of like a library, painted black, that replaces the canon with magazines, comics, movies, games, and ice cream. I slip $30 through a tray slot and point to a low, wide booth. Cigarette smoke spirals around the blackened pipes that run across the exposed ceiling. All around me are rows of hip Japanese 20-somethings, faces illuminated in computer screen light, spending their Friday nights reading. There's no way to tell how long they've been here. The Manga Kissa provides for all their needs. There are vending machines full of food and cigarettes and sugary drinks. There are slippers and blankets and pillows. The toilets are equipped with showers, bowls of toothbrushes, and little girls' kits that have disposable swabs and cotton tips in case you need to fix your makeup or your drug habit. And if the body threatens atrophy, there are solarium rooms for a dose of the warming artificial sun, and treadmills to bring movement to the joints and sweat to the aircon stretched skin. I love it here in the lonely artificial future. I'm going to stay here all night. Hour one. One Nescafe creamy iced latte with added chocolate cocoa mix and a scoop of soft serve. This sounds a bit like Bridget Jones. Cyber Bridget Jones. I take a walk around the space, letting my eyes flick across the colourful spines of millions of manga titles. A manga subgenre I'm totally captivated by is boys' love. These are manga erotica titles about homosexual relationships between boys, but they're aimed at a readership of girls. Boys' love is also known as yaoi, an acronym taken from the Japanese phrase yamanashi, ochinashi, iminashi, which translates as no climax, no point, no meaning. This is only referring to narrative climax, however. There are plenty of the other stickier kind of climax, and the yaoi acronym is sometimes cheekily referred to as Yameti oshiri ga itai, or stop, my butt hurts. Boys Love creators unanimously declare that this genre story is irrelevant and exists only to give spurious context for more anal sex. Typically, Boys Love titles focus on a sexual relationship between two boys. One is a sem and one a yuk, terms which derive from martial arts and can be translated as pitcher and catcher, or hilariously in some translations as insertive and receptive partners. I spot the big pink decorative sign, select a series with big-eyed twinks and zoo animals on the cover, and head back to my booth via the soft serve machine. Hour two. Affogato made from soft serve and black vending machine coffee. The secret to a good soft serve affogato is to fashion the ice cream into a volcano formation and then teaspoon the coffee into the crater. How is it possible to serve French fries from a vending machine? Do you think a hot dog would be a better or worse choice? At a desk near the candy machine, there's a guy in a business suit with a stack of 3 packs of Camel unfiltered cigarettes and at least 10 thick tome-like comic books. He has a determined but peaceful expression on his face. The cigarettes and the comics will be consumed by dawn. I crawl into my booth and draw the curtain against the world. Under the desk lamp, my cartoon nasties glow brightly through the smoke-sick haze. The protagonist of Sex Pistols by Taroko Kotobuki is an angular, girly uke. From the first page, he's shown brutalised at the whim of various businessmen who can morph into animals. The sex scenes are nightmarish and surreal. Faces distort. The uke's eyes bulge as he takes another suited baboon's member. His main lover slash rapist is a tall Sem who turns into a cheetah in the sack and purrs like a kitten after the act. It's a dramatic relationship. In addition to balancing their sadomasochistic dynamic with a tender and supportive undertone, there's the whole anthropomorphic factor and with it, the laws of the jungle. Like sometimes, a cheetah has to kill a bear to keep him away from his hole. In the second chapter, we find out the Sem has a girlfriend. While the Sem is totally blasé and seems uninterested in untangling the structure of his desire for either of his partners, our uke feels betrayed. How could he? The girlfriend is gross, monstrous even. Her tits, ass and lips are blown out of proportion. Her eyes are blank, the pupils shattered. She's not a real woman at all, but a monstrous fuck doll, a caricature of grotesque societal values. Spurned, our uke turns to other men and is dressed as a schoolgirl, a nurse and a slut and impaled on the laps of various impassive, anonymous Sems. You can tell he's on a downward spiral. Then one day, soaked, stretched and wretched upon the cruel dong of emotional neglect, it all becomes too much. Our little uke scrunches his eyes up into a pained grimace. He tenses every muscle in his tiny, oversexed body, grits his teeth and turns into a small monkey. Perhaps a marmoset. This morphic episode represents personal catharsis and corresponds with his acceptance of his own sexuality, i.e. submissive twink and loving it. In the books which follow, the more we see him as a monkey, the girlier, camper, and also the happier his human form becomes. It's life-affirming, cute, and X-rated all at once. Hour 4. One miso soup in a paper cup, one blue-flavoured powdered milk drink, one single application soothing eye drops. If you take away all the gore, the endless cycle of rape revenge and the psychedelic body dysmorphia, the relationships in Boys Love titles are pretty romantic. Couples have a lot of violent sex, commit the odd glee murder, but they also take long, relaxing baths. A Sem ruffles a uke's hair while he's washing it. They play like the members of Def Leppard in a fancy hotel suite. Bubbles float across the cell in slick heart shapes. Boys Love comics are hot for girls. That's why they sell. And from a critical perspective, they also destabilize the rape sex fantasy taboo. When you recast the actors as men, you remove women from the object read victim position. In absentia, you can enjoy the image without being implicated by it. This is re-emphasized by the medium. There are no human actors in comics, therefore the immoral, exploitative elements of porn as well as the medical ick factors are avoided. So Boys Love is violent fucking for fun without prescriptive definitions of oppression and abuse. It's not advocating violence against women because there are no women other than the creators and the fans. And there are no real men either. Boys Love Boys are object men created by women, for women. And the women who draw them and the women who read them want brutality, not responsibility. This has its own problems, but like I said, there's a hot factor. And if women want these kind of images, why shouldn't they have them? Men get them every day. It seems to me that the romance genre is toughing up all over. A similar strategy is deployed in the countless supernatural sex narratives we've been seeing lately. If it's no longer girl meets boy, but girl meets wolf or vampire, or just watches while the twink's 69 in the abandoned playground, all the established rules of heterosex are off and imagination hops back into bed. Hour 6. One vending machine hot dog. Should I be ashamed of that? I think you'd eat it too if you were here. A rubber wiener wrapped in bread the texture of fairy floss and served in a beautifully ornate box. The digital clock on the toilet seat tells me it's 5 a.m. Everyone is quiet now, though not necessarily sleeping. In the black no time, no space, we're all smoking or eating sugar and reading. We are no point, no climax, no meaning, all quietly absorbed together, and it's comforting. The smoke has sunk low as a dreamy morning mist. My eyes are puffy and the inside of my mouth feels like a uke's anus. I need natural light. I want to walk on solid ground. At the desk, I pay and smile and head out into the early morning city. The heat of the day is previewing as Japanese cleaning crews set to work picking up all the scraps of the night before. Old women hunch over and clean the grit and gum from the cracks in the pavement. Flyers for strip clubs and all-night shop bars are packed up for the incinerator. In 1 hour, the whole city will be clean. Efficiency and escape. These seem to be the two major principles of Japanese cities. Participation is mandatory. Employment, work ethic, consumption, and then, when you need to, you escape into the predetermined escape holes like Mangakissa. Transgression is performed in prescribed ways. There is no way that Mangakissas could exist in Australia. They'd be full of drunken, loutish man gangs and noise and bad nu metal. In Japan, we can all be quietly and politely unwholesome together before heading back into the bright, sanitised future. I blink, adjusting my eyes to the third dimension. In the sky, the neon sign buzzes and shouts, "We love escape! Thank you for enjoying your escapism. Please remain productive. We love enjoying imagination. Please leave your imagination at the designated space to enjoy next time." And the doors to the shopping mall open wide to take me in.
Amazing. Bryony Doyle taking you for a ride inside a Japanese manga kiss where people can be found reading a fairly unique world of comic books all hours of the day. Coming up in a little while, we'll be hearing from Elmo Keep. But right now, from a record by an Australian hip-hop group called Mnemonic Ascent. The record was called The Book's Full. This one's called Hold Back. You're an FBI.
You keep what you're feeling inside, all buried and boxed up inside. The love that you're feeling inside, the pity you're feeling inside. Society tells you to stay cool and shout you would gladly.
Hey, you're listening to FBI Radio. My name's Matt Levinson. I'm sitting in for Eliza Zalos today, who is, well, appropriately sitting in an exam right now. She's been studying hard, probably in a library all week. And today on the show, we're all about the library. It's been all recordings of fantastic Sydney writers reading their work at Surry Hills Library sometime last month. As part of a late night thing, lots of fairly risque topics broached. Fantastic writers coming up in just a little while. Well, we've just got a bit left of all the best today. American Psycho is still one of the very few restricted novels in Australia. It was a cult classic when it was released back in 1991, and it still, you know, it still has that frisson of risk about it today. When Elmo Keep was young, all she wanted to do was read it, rats in the inner tubes and all. This is a story about her trying to read that story.
My name's Elmo Keep. They say brevity is the soul of wit, so this is not a very funny essay. This is about being haunted, I guess, by a personal library. In the summer of 1991, I was 10, and my father had bought a copy of American Psycho. He sat one Saturday afternoon in his living room armchair reading it, and I remember this vividly for two reasons. One was that I was both fascinated and terrified by the cover art, which depicted what looked like a man wearing a mask made out of flesh. And the second was a typically understated warning from my father, who looked at me dourly over his glasses in the top of the book at once, saying, "You can never, ever read this book. Okay? Okay. Do you promise? Okay. But why? Because it's definitely not suitable for anyone." He said this as he turned back to the pages. So, this was a bind. I wanted to do what my father told me, but more than that, I wanted to read American Psycho. As a child, I used to spend an inordinate amount of time in my father's study. Because it was the late 1980s, everything in it was either metallic and black or white or made of glass. Everything inside there was perfectly ordered and it was quiet. It was a sharp, cool riposte to the rest of the house, which was shambolic and dark, and things always seemed to be clattering somewhere or tripping you over. It was not like that in my father's study. The room smelled of two things, stale cigarettes and leather. There was the leather of his chair, which swamped me when I sat in it, and the leather of his heavy appointment book with the year embossed in gold on the front, the thick red ribboned bookmark the days sticking out at the bottom. And there was the leather of his briefcase, which was always locked, its combination of numbers a mystery to me, and I learned later it was just three zeros, which he never bothered to reset. And I would go in there in the evenings when my mother was downstairs occupied and my father was at the pub down the road, and I would sit there in the still of that room in the white carpeted floor of my father's desk under that desk and read. In Australia, American Psycho is Category 1 restricted, and it still comes in shrink wrap today. You have to be over 18 to buy it. And when it was placed under restricted sale, it was a big deal. Everyone was talking about it. Opinion pages burned with it. People on television warned against it. Older kids at my school reckoned they'd read parts of it or all of it or at least heard about the very worst passages. The rat in the container scene got a lot of mileage being retold, but no copy of it ever materialised in anyone's hands. And there was a copy at my house, and this naturally only fueled the feelings of intense curiosity and repulsion that I already had for the book, which I'd seen my father place on the uppermost shelf in his study, on a bookshelf that towered over his desk, the top of which was made of glass. My father knew that I liked to spend time in that room in the house, so he put the things he really didn't want me to get out on that shelf. So cigarettes, his lighter, magazines that weren't suitable. And if I'd stood on that glass desktop, I might have been able to reach the top shelf, but I never dared try it because several experiments I'd undertaken leaning my full weight on my hands on the glass while standing on the chair pulled up to the desk led me to believe it would not withstand me standing on it. I was less concerned with falling through a pane of glass than I was with incurring my father's wrath and never being allowed back in the study again. My obsession with reading the book waned until months later when in some momentary lapse my father had left it within my reach. "Abandon all hope, ye who enter here," it famously begins, is scrawled in blood-red lettering on the side of the chemical bank near the corner of 11th and 1st and is in print large enough to be seen from the back seat of the cab as it lurches forward in the traffic leaving Wall Street. And just as Timothy Price notices the words, a bus pulls up, the advertisement for Les Miserables on its side, blocking his view. But Price, who's with Pierce and Pierce and 26, doesn't seem to care because he tells the driver he will give him $5 to turn up the radio, "Be My Baby" on YWNN, and the driver, black, not American, does so. YWNN. Les Miserables. Be My Baby. None of this meant anything to me. I was equally disappointed and relieved to have not read a scene of unimaginable horror, The Rat. Still, I skipped ahead to a random page, hoping, and read what could have been countless passages of mundane description. Anything could have been about which tie knot was less bulky than a Windsor, or how to wear a pocket square, or a monologue about watermark business cards, or a treatise about Huey Lewis and the News, or an argument about which was the best restaurant table in Manhattan. Whatever it was, I was definitely not scandalized. Carefully replaced the book exactly as it had been on the desk, and I didn't think about it again for about 15 years. I have read every Bret Easton Ellis novel except American Psycho, which I could never finish. Abandon all hope, ye who enter here. I just can't cope with the violence, even when I can read something like Blood Meridian twice. And when my father died, I got all his books, but the copy of American Psycho is not among them. Just lots of esoteric stuff like Leonardo's Mountain of Clams and The Diet of Worms and the Penguin Book of Historic Speeches, the Philosophy Gym, loads of John Updike and Martin Amis, which all just makes me think of him whenever I read Bret Easton Ellis and wonder, who were you? I walk around the corner from our house one afternoon to the bookshop where my father had brought his copy of American Psycho. And where, while at university after I'd left home, I used to work for extra money over the Christmas break gift wrapping their books. The shop has remained unchanged in 19 years longer, actually, and I buy myself a copy of the new edition of American Psycho. And while the shrink wrap remains the same, the cover does not. Its style, like all the others, is minimal and non-threatening. This will be the third time I've attempted this book after lying precociously in high school about finding it not so hardcore, yet having been defeated less than halfway through, and failing to get through it again at university 2 years later where it had been a set text. I'm home in Sydney alone in the winter while my partner is away in New York. He writes me emails from the University Club and the Chelsea Hotel, which arrive in the middle of the night, and I'm alone with American Psycho, reading about that city's streets of almost 20 years ago. Again, I'm repelled by the most violent pornographic depictions throughout, and I try flying over those passages, skimming them. But I find that the true trick of the novel is the way it forces you to reread them, because in those pages, sidled in somewhere might be the point, the reason for its being that I'm looking for, the reason why I'm persisting. And in itself, that is the point. To emerge from its pages exhausted and numb, there has been no reason for me to tell you any of this. This confession has meant nothing. I'm struck mainly by the cadence of the prose, by how similar the sentences often are structurally to Joan Didion's, how the unrelenting tide of advancing consumerism it skewers has only grown more pronounced and more grotesque in the last 20 years. I laugh at an early depiction of a 30-inch television, which was at the time the peak of consumer technological decadence, and how this pales in comparison to a 70-inch wall-mounted plasma screen that I'd seen recently in the shopping mall, and how prophetic it was in its repeat mentions of the fictitious Patty Winters show. The Patty Winters show this morning was about people with half their brains removed. When thinking about the current proliferation of talk shows and celebrity docudrama franchises. American Psycho is about hearing the same vapid pop song wherever you go. It's about people with interchangeable names who are indistinguishable from one another. No one in the book has a face. Their features are never described to the reader, as Norman Mailer noted in his lengthy essay, The Children of the Pied Piper, in Vanity Fair. It is not, Bret Easton Ellis always explicitly said whenever asked, which was often, about him. I don't know exactly what I was hoping to find the book to be about. I try to imagine what my father would have made of it and why he didn't hold on to his copy. It is not, clearly, anything about my failing to meet him at the bar where he died, waiting for me and wanting to tell me something. Bret Easton Ellis is visiting Sydney on his first ever speaking tour. It's to promote his new novel, Imperial Bedrooms. I'm covering the event for a magazine, so I'm reading a lot about him. To find a copy of the Mailer essay, I go to the State Library in the city, one of the oldest buildings in Sydney. It's in Macquarie Street at the top of the financial district. I like that library a lot. It's where I spent endless hours as a student. But I have little reason to go there these days, and even less so to navigate that part of the city at all, with its Reserve Bank building and law firms and differing corporate headquarters housed in the neoclassical and Art Deco buildings lining the pedestrian mall of Martin Place. Whenever I go there now, I feel a chill of premonition, and I want to leave as quickly as possible. I often went to that part of the city as a child when my father had an office there, where he traded futures on the stock exchange and was exceedingly good at making money for other people. He was never quite so good at making money for his own family, however, and in the stock market crash of 1987, he lost everything, our savings, most of his friends, and his job. After a few years, the bank repossessed the house, and my father studied with it. And so we moved to a smaller rented house, a cycle that would repeat itself every 2 years or so for about the next decade, whenever the money ran out or the lease got broken. We were perpetually shedding our possessions, but never my father's books. He took them everywhere with him. Even when eventually my mother kicked him out and he moved into a single room in a boarding house, he kept them with him then. That's where he called me from one afternoon to arrange to have a drink at the bar, but for whatever reason I can't remember, I'd said no. I've been so busy, I think I said. The place where Bret Easton Ellis came to talk about imperial bedrooms could best be described as Bret Easton Elysian. The rock club on Oxford Street, the Oxford Art Factory, looks and feels like it was modelled on a party from the film version of Less Than Zero. And though ostensibly there to talk about his new novel, Bret Easton Ellis dedicated almost the entire evening to talking about American Psycho. In particular, to divulge the fact that his novels are about him. And this would seem to run counter to the last 25 years he's dedicated to keeping the private details of his life private, culminating in the metafictional non-memoir Luna Park. I was so defensive about American Psycho when it first came out because of all its controversy, he said, from where he was seated in a chair on the stage. And I would make these grand sweeping statements like it was about Wall Street and it was about misogyny and it was about yuppie culture and it was about consumerism. And it was really about me. And it was about my life. I had moved to Manhattan when I was about 23 and I was roughly Patrick Bateman's age when I was writing the book. And I was going to all the places that Patrick Bateman was going to and I was trying to fit into the world of adults. And I think I was disgusted by what the values were of this particular world I was moving into, which was just basically the world of adults, you know. It wasn't that it was such a contemptible society. It's just that you have that movement from when you're very young to having to accept the morals and the values of the adult world. And so I was really writing a lot about myself in the process of writing American Psycho, the kind of conflicted relationship that I had with him, which I've since resolved, but I had daddy issues, what can I say? Patrick Bateman was in a lot of ways me, and I only feel comfortable saying that now. I stand in our living room.
Leave Elmo Keep there. Most of us, well, we know the ending to the story, American Psycho, but that essay by Elmo is a totally fascinating one. We have sadly run out of time on the show for it today. We'll put the full recording up on our website later today or soon after. We'll be tweeting about it very soon. You can also find that essay or Elmo's essay about American Psycho and Bret Easton Ellis, I think, in Mianjin coming up. And she's a fabulous writer. Very well worth seeking out. Thanks very much for listening to All the Best today. Thanks to Surrey Hills Library. You can find out more about the late night events there. We'll put the links on our website and on Twitter. Many thanks to everyone who was part of the show today. Elmo Keep, Vanessa Berry, Bryony Doyle, and Eddie Sharp, who wrote and performed our stories today. And thanks to our contributors, Kate Ryan and Antonia Gorci, for producing that content for air. Next week, we're looking at value. You know, the value of the life of an old racing greyhound called Sparky, the value of 5,000 comic books to one guy, the value of someone's lifelong possessions after they've died, and a life lived trying to escape the value of consumer goods. All that and probably a hell of a lot more. That's next week on All the Best. That's Saturday, June 25th, 10 till 11 a.m. here on FBI Radio. Thanks so much for joining me. My name's Matt Levinson. But next week, Eliza will be back in the studio, hopefully having passed her exam with flying colours. I'm thinking of you riding away right now. Coming up, one song to finish up before Kate Chinks comes in for Too Much. This is Vintage Books by Cloud Control. Will you wait like a wait for you?